Greetings and felicitations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this September 2011 Science News Update. I'm your host for this evening of Sciencey Science, Jim Campanella. Let's get this show on the road. First, my apology to all the Dutch speakers out there. I was corrected on my pronunciation by one of our kind listeners from the Netherlands, Bart van Beoyen. Bart actually gave me a pronunciation guide for his name, which I hope I got right, but I doubt I did. Bart told me that the Dutch potatoes I was talking about in the August 2011 Science News are not pronounced Binchi, they are pronounced Bintja, A as in again. Apparently they were bred by a schoolmaster and part-time farmer in the Dutch province, Friesland, which I also probably just pronounced incorrectly. He named them after one of his former female pupils, ahem, one Bintja Jansma. Bart tells me these potatoes are bland-tasting, fast-growing, and need lots of fertilizer and pesticides. Also, apparently they are so bland that most Dutch stores do not even sell them anymore. I guess they either must not grow them at all anymore in the Netherlands, or they export them. Bart did not tell me which of those things it was. Okay, now that that's out of the way, on to the first story of the night. I usually end with ant stories. Okay, I can hear the groans out there already, but tonight I'm going to begin with an ant story. Yay! Have you ever wondered why ants seem to be so good at taking up residence in various places once their ant hills are squashed or uprooted? If you have wondered about this, you're not the only one. Doctors Natalie Stromet and Nigel Franks from the University of Bristol have published an article this month in the Journal of Experimental Biology that looks exactly at that. Stromet collected ant nests from their coastal homes in the southern UK and relocated them to her lab, providing each community with a comfortable artificial nest in a well-supplied and spacious arena. Stromet placed an alternative nest site some distance from the ants' home and recorded the insects' movements as they familiarized themselves with their surroundings. Then a week later, she carefully destroyed their home after placing a second unfamiliar nest site on the opposite side of the arena. And then she recorded the entire emigration as the ants worked frantically to relocate. The question that she wanted answered was, which nest site would the ants occupy? Would they follow scouts that had learned about the attractive alternative site during early exploration? Or would they search randomly, relying only on their powers of self-organization in the hope of stumbling across a desirable site? After months of painstaking analysis by the researchers, they concluded that the ants eventually followed the informed scouts to the familiar alternative nest that had been in the enclosure all along. Initially, some of the insects went scampering off in all directions, but a few of the ants, which had discovered the location of the alternative site while scouting, ran straight to it. Having decided that the familiar site would make a good new home, they returned quickly to the devastated nest to recruit more colleagues, repeating the process and enlisting more followers until enough of the community had assembled to the new site and the decision made to relocate the entire population. The researchers also tested whether the informed ants relied on pheromone trails to direct them swiftly to their new home or navigated using visual memory of their surroundings. And they found that the ants were guided by their visual memories. According to Stromet, any member of the colony in most ant species can usually follow pheromone trails, while memories are only accessible to their owner. This led her to conclude that instead of following publicly available trails, relocating nestmates are being actively led by guides with access to privileged knowledge about the new nest site. After telling my wife about this ant story, she despaired a bit that there were not human equivalents to the ant scouts who could find you a new house. Not to be too disparaging, but let's say that the ant scouts do a better job of finding a new home for the ants than our realtor has. Onward. There are two new genomes that have been sequenced. One of them may be of interest to Harold and Kumar, if you recognize the movie reference. Researchers at Medicinal Genomics, a company headquartered in Marblehead, Massachusetts, announced a couple of weeks ago that they had compiled the complete DNA sequence for the two major species of cannabis, Cannabis sativa and Cannabis indica. The project is still half-baked, however, so to speak. They have all the pieces of DNA sequence, but the genetic information has not yet been fully assembled into the 10 chromosome pairs that are predicted for the species. nor has the data been analyzed to find genes and other important elements. The genetic data may lead to improvements in marijuana's medicinal properties, said company founder Kevin McKiernan, with a mysterious smile on his face. The other genome sequence is from the Tamar wallaby, a type of small kangaroo. An international team led by researchers at the Australian Research Council's Centre of Excellence in Kangaroo Genomics unveiled the genetic blueprints of a female wallaby from Kangaroo Island in the Journal of Genome Biology in the August 19th edition. Analysis of the genetic blueprints revealed that a gene called HOXD13 may be responsible for the wallaby's characteristic hop. The gene, which is involved in hind limb development, is turned off and on at different times in wallabies than it is in humans and mice, leading to longer back legs. Okay, on to another topic. My wife rarely gets sick, but I seem to catch everything that my children bring home from school. This has often irked me, and in the back of my mind I've wondered if it is purely genetics that control whether you're likely to catch something like a cold or not. Well, it appears that the flu virus does cause different types of immune responses in different people based on the genetics of those people. In the last issue of the journal, PLOS Genetics, Dr. Alfred Hero, how's that for a cool name, and his team from the University of Michigan found that genetics play a profound role in getting sick. The researchers infected 17 volunteers with a strain of seasonal flu called H3N2 Wisconsin. 9 of the volunteers who got treated with this flu virus got sick. Some of the others reported feeling under the weather, but had no clinically discernible symptoms. The researchers drew blood before the flu inoculation and every 8 hours for 5 days after the initial infection. The team then examined the activity of about 22,000 genes in each blood sample. Hero said, quote, "The persistent patterns that came out of this were striking, to say the least," unquote. Gene activity patterns could predict up to 36 hours before symptoms peaked how sick people would get, the researchers found. Those who got sick activated immune chemicals that trigger inflammation and stress responses. In asymptomatic people who didn't look like they had the flu, the immune response was just as active, but dramatically different in nature. People who stayed well not only repressed the stress responses, but they also activated anti-inflammation and antioxidant genes. The study illustrates that gene activity analysis may help doctors determine which patients are most in danger of getting seriously ill. But the current study hasn't put the entire story together yet, says Hero. Researchers still need to determine whether the different patterns of responses depend upon the person's genetic makeup, properties of the virus, or other factors. Hero added that the people in the study may react differently to other flu strains or even to the same one under different circumstances. The technology used in the study may one day help doctors diagnose which viruses are infecting babies with fevers and predict which infants will end up in the intensive care unit and which ones can go home. The people who stayed well tended to spread fewer flu viruses than people who got sick, the study also showed. So healthcare workers might be able to test people exposed to a virus and determine from gene activity patterns who needs to be quarantined to limit the spread of an infectious disease. Next up is a bit of an update from some earlier stories about our ancient cousins, and it's also related to the immune system. You may remember that at one point or another we have mentioned that there is genetic evidence that Homo sapiens apparently interbred thousands of years ago with both Neanderthals and the recently discovered and mysterious Denisovans. We have never come back to mention what the consequences of those interspecies relationships may have been to the human genome. As it turns out, we probably owe a lot to both of those species for improving the human immune system. Dr. Laurent Abi-Rashad and his team from the Stanford University School of Medicine published an article in the journal Science at the end of August that suggests that sleeping around in the short term may be bad for you because it can expose you to diseases, but at least in the course of human evolution, it might actually help to fight off diseases. New research suggests that thousands of years ago, humans acquired important immune system genes via, well, liaisons with some of our extinct hominid cousins, that is, the Neanderthals and the Denisovans. These romantic dalliances may have allowed modern humans to persist in regions where unfamiliar pathogens may have otherwise killed them. Modern Eurasian genomes contain up to 4% of Neanderthal DNA, and DNA of Melanesians of Papua New Guinea is 4 to 6% of those mystifying Denisovans. The researchers decided to home in on three particular immune system genes called HLA genes. These genes help the body recognize foreign and potentially dangerous invaders. In fact, these same genes that are used in HLA matches in donors and recipients are crucial for transplants of organs and other tissues, because if they don't match up, then organ rejection will inevitably occur. Using the genetic blueprints of three Neanderthals, the one Denisovan that's been found, and present-day genetic information from bone marrow stem cell donor registries, the researchers compared the frequencies of various versions of the HLA genes. Computer simulations were used to assess whether the observed frequencies were unusual. The results of the study support that humans were definitely producing offspring with Neanderthals and Denisovans. In some instances, those offspring acquired archaic versions of the genes that imparted such a benefit that they eventually became widespread. One Denisovan version of an HLA gene, for example, seems to be present in 50 to 60% of people in China and Papua New Guinea. The authors say the results are exciting but urge caution in interpreting the new data. Because immune system genes would be subject to intense selection, having the wrong ones would be fatal and they'd be gone from the gene pool, it isn't exactly clear what factors shaped the present-day genetic patterns. So exactly how these things got passed along and when will remain a mystery for a bit longer until more research has been done on the three genomes. Okay, the next story is a bit of a bummer to me, ironically, because I don't take Prozac. I don't know about you, but one of those things that I fear most about aging is not the aches and pains and the physical traumas that accompany it, but the fear of losing who I am to the rather nasty embrace of Alzheimer's. My family does have a history, although dementia is usually late to arrive at the table. My ancient relations did not show the signs of it until well into their 90s. Still, it is always the boogeyman hiding out there in the shadows of the future. Some new research published at the end of August in the Proceedings of the National Academy suggests that maybe I'd be better off if I was more depressed and not less. Dr. Michael Weiner and his colleagues at the Veterans Affairs Medical Center campus of the University of California, San Francisco, have found that antidepressants may reduce the ominous brain plaques associated with Alzheimer's disease in mice and humans. In the study, mice, genetically, were engineered to overproduce amyloid beta. That's the protein that Alzheimer brain plaques are mostly made from. The mice were given one of three selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, a class of antidepressants that boost circulating levels of the chemical messenger serotonin in the brain, of which Prozac is one of them. After a single dose of the antidepressants, amyloid levels dropped in the fluid that surrounds mouse brain cells. A full day after receiving the drug, the mice's amyloid levels fell by nearly a quarter. The long-term chronic administration of the drug had a larger effect. Engineered mice that took the antidepressant citalopram for 4 months had about half the amyloid plaques in their brains as mice that hadn't had the drug. This reduction seems to happen through a protein called ERK, which serves as the middleman between brain cells, serotonin-sensing protein, and amyloid production. Figuring out the details of this process may open up the door for developing new ways to prevent amyloid buildup, say the authors. To see if a similar effect might be happening in people, the scientists scanned the brains of 186 cognitively normal elderly people and looked for signs of amyloid plaques. The team used a compound called PIB that binds to big clumps of amyloid in the brain and glows on a PET scan. Of these participants, 52 reported that they had taken an antidepressant in the last 5 years. These people, researchers found, had about half the amyloid load in their brains as the people who hadn't taken an antidepressant. What's more, the length of time the participants took the drugs correlated with the density of amyloid plaques in the brain. The longer the antidepressant dose, the less plaque. Weiner says, quote, "We think depression pushes you toward dementia, but antidepressant treatment pushes you toward protection, unquote. He adds, quote, finding similar results in mice and humans lends the study credibility. When you have animal data and human data coming together, then you start to get really excited, unquote. He warns, however, not to get too excited until serious clinical studies have been performed. He says that his study uncovered an association, not a clear-cut cause and effect. Weiner notes, quote, we cannot say with certainty that the reason why people who took the antidepressants have lower cortical amyloid is due to the fact that they took antidepressants. We only know there's an association there. The authors also state that they don't know if just reducing the amount of amyloid will help ameliorate Alzheimer's. It may be that by reducing the plaques 20-50%, nothing clinical will actually change. So, it seems that we may have to wait a bit longer to see whether this is a serious breakthrough or just a coincidence. The real question is this, and the paper does not shed any light on it. Does this result mean that long-term antidepressant-treated patients will have less of a risk of dementia? And that's exactly where a big study needs to be done. Okay, the final story of the night is another one which you might call, quote, let's shed light on Dr. Campanella's anxieties, unquote. Yes, it's another story related to dementia. Now, some people might suggest that I already border on the demented, but I will ignore them for the moment. As my wife will tell you, based on my snoring and erratic nighttime breathing, I probably have sleep apnea. I have never officially had this diagnosed, but it is not really a problem, or it hasn't been a problem. It goes away as long as I don't sleep on my back. Now, this new article is telling me that not only am I at risk to stop breathing if I sleep on my back, I may go mad as well. Well, I'm sure many of my colleagues and my family would heartily support that it is probably already too late for me in that department, but let's just talk about the story here. The story was published in early August in the Journal of the American Medical Association. It found simply that breathing irregularities that rob the brain of oxygen during sleep may imperil a person's ability to think straight. A study of women 65 and older finds that those with seriously disordered breathing have an increased risk of developing mild cognitive impairment or dementia in subsequent years. Dr. Christine Yaffe of the University of California, San Francisco, and her colleagues tested 298 women, average age 82, from 2002 to 2004 for sleep problems. They monitored each individual overnight and noted any stoppages of airflow in their breathing, as well as arousals from sleep. About one-third of the patients had disordered breathing. None of these women was cognitively impaired at the time of the sleep test. After the test, patients were given their scores and told if they showed signs of severe sleep problems. When researchers repeated standard cognition tests on the women roughly 5 years later, 45% of those who had disordered breathing had developed dementia or milder cognitive impairments, compared with 31% of those with no breathing irregularities. In particular, women who had 15 or more breathing stoppages per hour and who spent more than 7% of sleep time not breathing during the earlier part of the study were nearly twice as likely as those without breathing problems to develop dementia or other cognitive impairments. Such problems can include forgetfulness, confusion, and reasoning problems. In one of the most insightful statements ever to come out of medical thought, one of the authors stated, quote, clearly hypoxia isn't good for the brain, unquote. Yes, that was sarcasm. Please, Dr. Obvious, please tell me when lack of oxygen has ever been found to be good for the brain. The only treatment for severe sleep apnea presently is wearing an oxygen mask that continually keeps your breathing passages open. Since no medications are known to prevent mild cognitive impairment from progressing to dementia or Alzheimer's, the authors have suggested, quote, treating at-risk patients with breathing apparatus for sleep disordered breathing as a prevention strategy, unquote. They say that it may be worth testing. Oh, and one other thing to note about this study. It is very rare that a physiological study like this is done on just women. So this is one of the first times that The woman's data is the baseline data. The study has yet to be conducted on men and the results known. Not that I have a great deal of hope that it will be otherwise than what they found with the women, but it's nice to see that several hundred years of medical research protocols are changing and not depending so heavily on the human male. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care, take your antidepressants, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.